In the next 5 minutes, I would like to actually review with you a typical way that I teach the Christian year in an adult education session in a congregation. Right? This is actually straight from teaching adult education sessions on the Christian year. Now I'm going to compress this in 5 minutes, right? Maybe six, right? But not too much more than that. And what I'd like you to do with me is reflect on the, not the content, because I'm going to assume that most of us through the IWS program have been immersed, or that guests who are here for the very first time in an IWS thing have some broad sense of the Christian year. So I actually would like the discussion to be about how we teach it. And by my doing this for 5 minutes, I want to sort of just get us all up to the same, up to speed with some of the same content in the air. And I want you to invite, to reflect with me on the strengths, but also the weaknesses of the way I teach. I have very thick skin here. This adult education session may not be the best way to frame it. I'd like to really push how we can work on this together. Okay, so are you ready for the 5 minute crash course? Okay. Here we go. Point number one, we all live by calendars. We are all hardwired into time. If I ask you right now, how long is it till lunch? You all know it's 45 minutes. You will all get that within 5 minutes, right? Most of us live our day by thinking it's after breakfast and before lunch. It's after lunch and before supper. We orient our internal clocks in our days around meals. My kids organize their internal clocks around school bells. My daughter's class begins at 7:47 a.m., and I can tell you that at 7:31 in the morning, when she wants to leave so she's not late, her whole body is organized around being at school before that bell rings. And at 2:43, when her class ends, I can tell you that an hour and a half before that final bell, she's already looking forward. Her day is organized by the school bell. Our lives are organized by calendars. I know that right now is about 2 weeks after we have many birthdays in our families. I've got the family birthday calendar that is hardwired into my brain that I'm oriented to. Yeah, that's one important calendar. We all know that Walmart lives by another important calendar. The Walmarts live by the calendar of the shopping season. All right, the Christmas shopping season, pretty soon it'll be Valentine's. Valentine's Day has already started, hasn't it? Yeah. St. Patrick's Day will follow, and so it will go, the shopping season. I guarantee that with my kids, though, there is another calendar by which we live that is incredibly important, otherwise known as the ESPN calendar. Right now, it is the culmination of the NFL. We are halfway through the eternal season of the NBA. And we are really getting ready for March Madness and spring training. And we're just kind of implicitly oriented to these calendars. We are hardwired to live in time. And what the Christian calendar is about is about claiming that hardwiredness in us for the sake of Jesus. Organizing how we live in time to the person of Jesus. That's number one. Number two, which I'm not going to dwell on, calendars are not new. Calendars were what God's people lived by in the Old Testament. Organizing their calendars not only around Sabbath celebrations every week, but about feasts every year. And in the early church, those calendars were taken over so that Jesus could be at the center. I'm really skipping fast here, right? This is just all summary and review. Number four. And what emerged was a Christian calendar that involved two kinds of observances, feasts and seasons. The feasts, day-long celebrations of key events in Jesus' life. His birth, visitation by the Magi, baptism, transfiguration, arrival into Jerusalem, death, resurrection, ascension. And then the seasons, which help us prepare and reflect. And then I do take time to explain how that works a bit more. Each one of these feasts and seasons involves two things, especially the feasts. It involves telling the story and exploring the meaning. Telling the story and exploring the meaning. So at Christmas, we tell the story of Mary, Joseph, a baby, shepherds, angels. At Epiphany, we tell the story of Magi. On Easter, we tell the story of resurrection. But we never just tell the story, we also explain what the story means. We savor part of the force or meaning of the story. The main goal, number six, I'm flying through to get through here in 6 minutes, is always to put Jesus at the center. And if we do our job well at church, what we want to have happen is to have people wake up in the morning ready to get the NFL scores from last night, because we all know we're going to live by the ESPN calendar. Right? Some of us, at least, are realizing. Right? But we also want people to wake up in the morning grateful for the baptism of our Lord, so that there's some part of Jesus' life that is always front and center in our attention. And the good news is that what we get with it is not just Jesus at the center, but we also get a balanced diet in the life of faith. Part of the year, we dwell in hope. Part of the year, we dwell in penitence. Part of the year, we dwell in celebration. And of course, I could talk for some length about that. There is no need, number eight, to overemphasize this tool. The Christian year is a tool. And the Bible itself warns us against being judgmental about the use or non-use of specific strategies. And in fact, it's important for me, cheerleader for the Christian year, to say very explicitly, going on here, that this use is not prescribed in the New Testament. It's a good thing. It's quite universal around the world and throughout time. But it is only valuable as a Christian tool of wisdom that helps put Jesus at the center. There are several curiosities in the Christian year. Sometimes these can become our main focus. Kids in church can spend a whole month trying to figure out why one of those four candles in the Advent wreath is pink. And I can assure you that actually there are reasons and explanations, but none of them really register at the level of all that being important. And so while we want to defend the Christian year, we want to be cautious about some of those little details. And then I would leave people, I think I've done it in 6 minutes, with a little suggestion about a verse from the Psalms to guide their shape of the Christian year. But the main point of the Christian year, once again, is to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. Now, that's the 5-minute version of it, right? This would go for an hour. There'd be questions, dialogue, response, and the like. But just on the basis of the 5-minute overview, think with me, not about the content, but about the pedagogy of it. Things that you appreciate, but things that you wonder about that might be weak or that you would want to have me address. I've got thick skin here, but just kind of to get some discussion going, let's think about the pedagogy of the Christian year. Ways that you've taught the Christian year. Strengths. Let's reflect a little bit on that. Go ahead.
The early church wouldn't have said, I understand, not keep your eyes on Jesus, but Trinitarian.
Yeah.
More so than Jesus at Christmas.
Yeah, thanks. Well, okay, and actually, I will not disagree with that whatsoever, right? In fact, actually, to keep our eyes on Jesus, I would actually, very good point, right? Christocentric and Trinitarian to me actually go just, right, perfect synergy between the two. Making that explicit, I'm going to go home and edit my handout to make that clear. Very good. Love it. Other comment in the back? See? Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not entirely comfortable with the word tool.
Okay.
I think there might be another way to, another metaphor to use, or lambs or something, you know.
That, I like it.
Yeah, tool, you know, we also look at liturgy as a tool as Protestant.
Yeah.
Really, prayer is not a tool.
Yeah. I think that's very good. Lens, I like. Right? It's we see certain things through this that unfold. Right. What I'm I'm working on there, with the choice of tool comes from this. It comes from my concern that often the Christian year is taught as an end. Right? That you get the idea that sort of the point of the Christian year is the Christian year. The point of the colors are the colors. So I think maybe I've got to say that, yeah, when I teach it, I'm kind of working that, I'm working that problem out. And if that's not the problem, then you need a different metaphor. So I think that's good. I point well taken, though. It's very good. Other comments, thoughts about it?
Christmas has been a challenge for the church year, because typically it's when you hear about the story of Christmas and Advent, then we discard it along with all the wrapping paper and never enjoy the season of Christmas. So at a new congregation, they find that a challenge. You know, these Advent themes don't ring well with them. They're just used to Christmas stories for 4 weeks and then on to New Year's.
Yeah, so let's think about that. Part of teaching, you know, it's thinking about winsome ways of re-describing the value of something, right? And I think maybe, what if we said, this would be an interesting thing, what if we tried to teach every day of the Christian year as a delightful opportunity to engage in some countercultural resistance? And I'm actually quite serious. Our church is all about delightful countercultural resistance. During December, the world says, be frenzied. Our church resists that. We refuse to be frenzied. We will engage in some delightful countercultural resistance. At Christmas, the world prefers to be sentimental. We will be delightfully countercultural in resisting sentimentality. I'd like to try that. That would be kind of good. I'm just trying. Right. That's good. It's good. Okay. Yep. Good.
I just want to comment that I think that's really important. We see ourselves as countercultural.
Yes.
As Christians, and the church be countercultural. So,
to affirm that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I like the way to affirm that.
Okay. Good. Yeah.
For us, we've spent some time dealing with the Advent issue, trying to draw a parallel between what the Jewish people were waiting for.
Yep.
And what, instead of just celebrating Christmas, which is the story of what has already happened, and we sort of draw the parallel of what are you waiting for God to save you from now, the way they were waiting then. And it brings a different twist to hope.
Yeah. All on the, this is the great line about in Advent, there are the three comings of Christ, right? The coming of Christ, the Christmas, the coming of Christ into our hearts, the coming of Christ at the end of time. And it's the analogy, the movement among these three comings out of which Advent gains its great power. And all of those Old Testament texts become real to us, right? We are the people of Israel in that sense. There you go.
And
yeah.
The question to ask, what story did you hear today? And where did you find yourself in that story?
Beautiful.
You know, that's the connection.
Beautiful. That's great, and I love the way you phrased the second question, right? What story did you hear, and where did you find yourself in the story? That's actually about exploring its meaning, but it's in very concrete terms. Absolutely. Go back now to page 2 of this handout. Some of these things I put in these handouts, we're not going to comment on every single thing. It's not like every handout's a perfectly logical teaching sequence. So I'm up here calling lots of audibles, actually, depending kind of how the conversation goes. I think that adult education thing that I was after, I mean, part of the challenge there is you can really offer sort of one thesis statement in an hour. Right? And so my thesis was, put Jesus at the center. But I think, actually, there could be another, here are some other possible thesis statements for presenting the Christian year. I think one of them is this matter of the Christian year is delightful countercultural resistance. You could actually take that handout and redo the whole thing with that as the main teaching thing. And you would be like the docent at the art museum going up to the Rembrandt, the Christian Year's the Rembrandt. One teacher is calling attention to the light color, to light and dark. The other teacher comes up to the Rembrandt and is telling you the beautiful way Rembrandt used different brush strokes. Right? You're talking about the very same practice, the very same painting, but you're calling attention to quite different things. Let me actually mention a third possibility that I find very provocative, and it came from theologian N.T. Wright. N.T. Wright once said this: the Christian year was the church's most potent anti-idolatry tool. Now there's a tool again, right? But the point is, it's an anti-idolatry tool. This is the Trinitarian theme coming out. And behind N.T. Wright's comment was this, that we all walk around with quite different perceptions of who God is and what God is like. Right? And songs will reinforce certain aspects of that vision of who God is and what God is like. But one of the great values of the Scripture, and especially the life of Jesus Christ, is that the scriptural accounts and the life of Jesus challenge and refine the little misconceptions that we might have of God. So there are all kinds of people who walk around with a view of God that is kind of sentimental. What a gift it is to give them a view of God as having the capacity to actually make a difference in history. There are other kinds of people who walk around with images and pictures of God as distant and fearful. A God whose power is sort of like Rambo's power, raw-fisted power. What a gift it is to challenge that misperception of God's character. And what Wright said is this, right? It's the Christian year that is one of the church's most potent anti-idolatry tools. If Jesus is, Colossians 1 and Hebrews 1, the perfect image of the invisible God, when we want to understand who God is, we look at Jesus. Jesus is the purest revelation, not just of who Jesus is, but of who God is. Through Jesus, we come to understand the triune life of God. Through Jesus, we come to understand each of the divine attributes more fully. We come to understand that divine power is not raw-fisted power, but that God chooses to express the unlimited capacity of God's power, often through things that seem powerless. Well, we are doing some very potent anti-idolatry work that's there. All right, so anyway, here are three different thesis statements as to the value of the Christian year. One of the things that I want to challenge us now is to think about how they can actually weave their way into the way we organize the worship ministries of our church, the little charts and documents and ways that we set things up. I'm not going to spend a long time on this, but do you see the complete background study template here that begins on page 2 and go to page 3? This was an experiment that I tried a couple years ago with an upper-level seminary class that ended up being one of the an incredibly generative and helpful experience. We took every single celebration of the Christian year and try to think about it from the perspective of every possible point of view. I mean, in fact, every single class in the Bible and theology part of a seminary curriculum. Right? Just follow me real briefly down the side. Right? So Monday, Thursday, and this chart is not all the way filled in. This is just a little sampling. Right? So for Monday, Thursday, Last Supper narrative, right? Students were asked to come up with the places in the Synoptic Gospels that talked about them. The Gospel of John. Old Testament texts that are relevant, and we could fill several of these in. And Old Testament texts that were related to Maundy Thursday in several different ways. Texts that predicted it in some way. typologies, Old Testament types that are echoed, like the manna account, God feeding his people, and then the Lord's Supper, spiritual nourishment. Exodus 24 is a type for Monday, Thursday, and so on. Other New Testament texts that expanded on the meaning of Monday, Thursday, right? So 1 Corinthians 11 and the Last Supper. I teach in a kind of confessional context, so we had students look at confessional documents as were related to those themes. And then we proceeded to take every single sub-theme in all of systematic theology. Like I said, this is a great way to review for your seminary comprehensive exams, right? To think about how this one celebration relates to every possible Christian doctrinal topic. In what way does Monday Thursday refer to the humanity of Christ, to the divinity of Christ, to a Trinitarian vision of God, to different names or images for the person of Christ, to the work of Christ, I'm just flying through these categories, in creation, incarnation, teaching ministry, priestly ministry, the ongoing intercession of Christ, the reign of Christ. What does this event have to do with union with Christ? To the objective benefits of union with Christ, to a spirituality or ethics of union with Christ, to the life of prayer, to the life of worship. What other doctrines are connected with this practice, like the doctrine of eschatology? What are central visual images for this feast? And then we talked a little bit about mistakes that churches make, historical actions, home run theological hymns, and key glossary terms. So what students did over the course of the semester is fill in this extensive teaching chart for every single day of the entire Christian year. And believe me, my goal in this session is not to talk about all those details. My reason for sharing the chart is this. Every single one of these Christian year celebrations is like a many-faceted jewel. We could preach a different Monday, Thursday sermon from now through the next 40 years and not get to the bottom of the beauty of Monday, Thursday or of Epiphany or of Christmas or of any of these days. But yet, most churches, I think, when you get back to the year, end up kind of repeating Monday, Thursday 101 from a certain point of view, right? Not unfolding the many splendor dynamism of it. And sometimes leaving the central thesis idea aside. So after we did this chart, and this is the point I'd like to get to now just a bit. The chart that really interests me, that's a seminary chart. So actually, if that chart just bewilders you, befuddles you, and makes you glad that you're not in seminary class, be comforted. The chart I am interested in is the chart that's on the top of the page. Telling the story, exploring the meaning, and then I just put as an illustrative point how this particular day in the Christian year is an anti-idolatry tool. So if part of our teaching happens through how we organize worship ministry, I'd like to challenge you to think about how would you design the little planning chart for your congregation? And I think realistic planning charts, right, these are not things you share with the congregation. Right? You might just do it if you are the one-person worship ministry of your church. Right? You're the volunteer worship leader for the house church with 17 people. You're the musician, the pastor, the bulletin writer. Sometimes this is all within one person. Most of us are probably in larger communities, right? What chart do you use to help organize your discussion about the Christian year? And what does the chart say about what you're trying to accomplish through the Christian year? And now I'm going to commend something as simple as this chart. It basically says, on Christmas Eve, are we telling the story? What Christmas Eve carols can you think that really are tell-the-story carols? Right, like First Noel tells the story. Silent Night tells the story. You see, the next category is a little different, though. Right? It's the explore the meaning. Christmas Eve is not just about a baby in the manger. It's about God becoming flesh. Right? Praise God, we have Luke 2 and we have John 1. Can you sort of feel it in your bones what it's like to be at a Christmas Eve service that's just Luke 2? Luke 2, Luke 2, Luke 2, Luke 2, Luke 2. And then I've been at a few Christmas Eve services, especially with young children, that just didn't have any point to connect in, which was all about the doctrine of the incarnation. John 1, John 1, John, John 1. And I just wanted a shepherd. I just wanted, like, the sheep to show up for Christmas. So this little simple chart ends up being a beautiful teaching tool to remind everybody who's shaping worship. We want to tell the story, and we want to explore the meaning, these two things. And now I'm the choir director. I'm thinking, I want to pick one song that's a story song. And I want to pick one song that's a meaning song. Now these categories are a little arbitrary. There's always meaning in the story, and there's always story in the narrative. And yes, Hark the Herald Angels Sing is one of the most theologically rich Christmas carols ever written. And yes, it has angels in it. But you see, it's a little bit more about the meaning and the incarnate. There is a spectrum, at least. Narrative and then reflections on the narrative. How beautiful to have services that always excel at doing both. So actually, now I'm thinking about it right now. I think actually, if you just took that last column out, you'd have a pretty good planning chart. But I think, actually, that in a lot of churches, it would be even better to have a third column. And the third column would be, suppose we were inspired by N.T. Wright's vision. In our congregation this year, we want to make sure that every Christian year service tells the story and explores the meaning. And look at, my goodness, this long seminary chart. Exploring the meaning can go off in 75 different directions. Right. But this year, we're going to discipline ourselves to always ask the question, what pernicious, idolatrous conception of God does this celebration of the Christian year help us joyfully leave behind? Resisting idolatry is a joyful thing. If it means setting aside conceptions of God that ultimately bog us down. So we want to make sure on Christmas that we narrate the upside down way in which God's power is exercised. That would just be an illustration. Right. How would you design the chart? I'm actually interested in selling you this chart. I'm just interested in how you would design a chart. That's what I'm interested in. Right. How would you design a chart in order to really help worship leaders at your church pay attention to the nuts and bolts and the mechanics of the Christian year, but also to its ultimate meaning? Right. We're working out what I had said earlier in the first lecture about iconic participation. Right. Any thoughts about what the chart would look like? Comments, thoughts, go ahead.
One of the books that your dear friend Lester Ruth gave me to read talked about misconception alerts.
Yeah.
So you have little boxes in the bulletin or in your teaching, the students or worship, misconception alerts. And the one dimensional, like baptism, misconception alert. You have to use so much water or whatever.
Great. I think the book on the Christian year is by Lawrence Stuckey, The
Yes.
Christian Year. It's a great appendix. Yeah, misconceptions about the Christian year. It's fabulous. That'd be a great little thing to put right in there, in the church, in the planning document. Misconceptions we are eager to avoid. Right? That Advent is just about looking for the baby Jesus. Yeah, it's not just about that. It's about so much more. So the, go ahead.
Just looking at the chart, maybe naming what the idol is.
Naming, pardon?
Naming what the idol is.
Oh, yeah.
More apparent.
Oh, I think that'd be great. Yeah. What I think I'd edit that in a fly. What is the specific idol we are interested in naming and resisting? To clarify it further. That's great. That's great.
I think if you're based on your faith camp that you're in, you may need more of a didactic element to this.
Yep.
If you're in a faith camp where you recite the Christian every year, it's great, but if you're introducing this to the church, your fourth column needs to be why.
There you go.
Especially for the little ones. The
Big difference. Some of us are in congregations where the Christian year runs on autopilot, and our job is awakening people to perceive its beauty in fresh ways, right? And so the tagline is, on the little poster in the back of churches, the Christian year is beginning again on the first night of Advent in 3 weeks. And this year in our church, we are shifting out of autopilot Christian year. And in some churches, you're introducing, and so you've got to do that background. Huge, huge difference. And I guess what I want to say, though, is it's incredibly important to pay attention to the why. Because the reason we celebrate the Christian year should determine the how. Right? And just because I want to not be totally against the use of footnotes, go to the first page of this little Christian year section, where there is some massive footnoted material. But I do want to do a little theological reflection. As the celebration of particular historical events, Christian liturgy is not merely a celebration of nature and natural cycles. Everything, by the way, that I say on this page is debatable. Which doesn't mean I don't believe it. It just means that a lot of people disagree. But I'm just telling you what I think. South African theologian Adrian Koenig places great emphasis on the fact that ancient Israel changed their calendar of feasts from one linked with nature into one that was tied to history. What's the big festival most churches celebrate in the United States that's linked with nature? Thanksgiving Day, Harvest Festival, right? Actually, I think it's a great thing. I'm all for it. I'm just not for having that be the only primary category. Koenig argues that the shift in practice corresponded to the theological commitment to conceive of God on the basis of God's actions in history. People in ancient Near Eastern cultures, they'd celebrate planting and harvest. They lived in a world that was cyclical. Time ebbed and flowed. Right? It's a kind of view of the world that coheres with what centuries later would be really deistic. Right? God is God, the world is the world, but God does not interact with the world. Right? The seasons come and go. Right? Planting time and harvest time, football season and baseball season. Right? It just goes round and round again. The interruption in ancient Near Eastern culture is that God intervened in history. God led the people out of Egypt into the Promised Land, and a festival was established to memorialize that specific event. And analogously, what we do are celebrate festivals that remember specific historical events. And the point of that is to help our imagination for who God is be grounded in these specific interventions in history, so that conceiving of God as an agent in history is at the center. And then the boldface text summarizes what I just said. The reasons why a given liturgical practice is commendable determine the way in which it is enacted. The Christian year is a valuable liturgical structure because it highlights the divine economy. Now, just you can cross that out if that doesn't make any sense or anything. The Christian year is valuable because it highlights what God has done in history in the consciousness of the Christian community. In other words, it replaces kind of vague attributes with specific concrete actions. The Christian year is not primarily valuable just because it is old, nor because it lends a kind of aesthetic balance to the annual rhythm of liturgical celebration. Its primary value is theological. It focuses the attention of the community on God's actions in history, primarily in the life of Jesus. And then the last bold-faced quote on this page, Jean-Jacques Van Ameghem, a Swiss theologian. The liturgical year prevents a docetization of the gospel. Docetization, that's the early church heresy in which people said Jesus sort of seems to be human, but really isn't. Divinity sort of floats above humanity. And the stunning part of the incarnation is that God became human. So that every time we want to reflect on the beauty and glory of God, we don't just go to Webster's and look up power and then say, God has lots of it. Webster's is not where we go. Where we go is to these specific events in history narrated by Scripture, specifically seen in the light of Jesus. All right. Now, the question then is, how does that change the teaching we do about worship? So here's my concern, right? Just like the docents walking people into the art museum doing a 45-minute lecture on frames, right, rather than artwork. One of my concerns with the Christian year is that often we spend a lot of attention on everything else, but on the specific way that God acted in that moment. And in a sense, one of the main questions that I'd love to get to is how could we tell parents on the way home from church in their minivan to ask the question, how did what we did today in worship change our understanding of who God is? See, well, that's a theocentric question. It's a question about theological imagination, about how we perceive God. And yet, even when I say that, my response to hearing myself is, that seems so unrealistic. Really? I'm going to ask parents to ask that question on the way home? So this is where we need some help, right? What do you think, what very practical strategies could we imagine to help our attention in Christian year celebrations be theocentric? Concrete actions in history, but always trying to embed that perception of how God acts in the actual working theological imagination we carry with us. I'm asking the question. Help me out here. Thoughts, reflections.
I don't have an answer, but I like it. I was uncomfortable with the idea of going home and saying, how was I blessed today?
Yeah.
Because it's me-centered that I'm going to foster this attitude that if I didn't get anything out of it, why would I come?
Yeah, I like
this. Whereas this, I like this direction much better. I don't know what the question is, but
yeah,
it's more, it's God-centered.
Okay. So we want a God-centered question, and we want to make the discussion realistic in the van ride home. The question might be, what aspect of God's... How did the story we told today about Jesus help us understand who God is? How did the story we told about Jesus help us understand who God is? Edit with me. Am I getting closer?
What did the story we heard today teach us about?
What did the story we heard today teach us about God? Right. Go ahead.
I think you're pushing to this. I think it's, what did the story today teach us about God's call to serve our neighbor?
Okay. I'll actually say it's both.
Yeah. Right.
The reason I don't want to have it just be about that is that then the attention goes like to God, and then it goes to what I have to do next. I want the doing to be there, but I want to also make sure the doing is grounded in being. Right? So that's the trick, right?
That God is the end.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. Right. So there are huge cultural challenges. Just speak to that a minute. So there's of course, there's part of me that likes to be the idealist and say you should never sing Christmas carols until Christmas and then sing them for the next 12 days and go to church every day so you can sing all the Christmas carols for the next 12 days. Life's threatened. And part of me is, you know, always appreciates that. I will say there are some thoughtful, creative, accommodating approaches. In my own congregation, almost every Advent service has in it a little crescendo, which always begins with O Come, O Come, Emmanuel in Advent, but always ends with Joy to the World. So that the movement is built into every Advent service of hope toward fulfillment. We get a little taste of Christmas early on. And I think that's a pretty wise pastoral strategy. Or the congregations on Easter that begin with the brass and Christ the Lord is risen today, but then we'll 7 or 10 minutes into the service say, and now let's tell the whole story. And we'll back up and say, here we were last Sunday and Palm Sunday, and let's journey through to experience. But there's a pastoral way of accommodating that move. Absolutely. Go ahead.
I understand the argument that you don't want it to be focused on yourself.
Yeah.
But for my kids, if I were going to have that conversation and I said, what did it teach you about God? They would say, he's good.
Yeah.
And then I'd almost want to back up and say, in the story we heard today,
yeah,
how do you identify with the people? Can you see any connection there? Is there anything you have in common with them? And then follow it up with, how did God act? And what did we learn about God as a result of walking through that?
It's good, sort of a variation on what story do we tell and where am I in that story would be our variation. I can feel the heart of excellent elementary education pedagogy kicking in, right? Which is fabulous. You know that for the stuff we're talking about today, the people in our congregations who have an enormous contribution to make are elementary school teachers. I want to put in a great word. When I was in seminary, I learned a few things from my seminary class. But I was blessed to be in a congregation that had a worship planning team. And on this worship planning team, there was the musician, a preaching pastor, and they insisted that on the worship planning team that met every week, there was, they called it a children's advocate. And they tried to find an elementary school teacher to be present. And I'm telling you, I learned a ton from just the presence of that way of thinking inside the process. Our time's going to be a little tight today for completely wrapping up this topic. But we're going to get several, as the seminar unfolds, we're going to be talking about, as you know, several different topics. And where I would love to go with the Christian year, and I'm going to just in 3 minutes at least hint, is this. I think with all of the themes we're talking about, that there are implications for what we do in worship, how we organize worship ministry, for informal teaching moments, for formal curricular moments, and for what we recommend that people do at home. Okay, in all five of these areas. In a sense, all we had time here to do is to talk a little bit about how something like the Christian year needs a guiding thesis that is deeper than just it's old and well-balanced. And the guiding thesis might be put Jesus at the center. The guiding thesis might be resist idols. The guiding thesis might be winsomely resist culture. But it needs a guiding thesis. And then I would suggest that guiding thesis affects, we started with the planning chart you'd use for worship ministry, but it also ought to affect all the other ways that we teach about worship informally. So I could imagine a poster in the choir room that had in it days of the Christian year and had in it simply a list of attributes for God, just on the board. And every time the choir met, what Christian year celebration are we getting ready for? And what attribute of God are we going to explore in a new way? Just that, in the choir room, is going to reinforce a kind of theocentric way of interpreting it. In a children's education program, and it will also matter for resources that you recommend for use in the home. So, brought with me a little guide, actually a little liturgy training press put out by a Catholic priest by the name of Paul Turner. And it's called, What Am I Doing for Advent This Year? And this is going to be a resource that in the vast majority of Protestant congregations, you will not be able to recommend because there's some very explicit Catholic things that will not transfer. But I was reading this with my handout in mind, and I was so thrilled because what did Paul write about here? It's all about expressing how our longing for Christ to come again is analogous to our expectation for Christmas. And actually, Paul has in it, if you were to read it in depth, a kind of theocentric, idolatry-resisting frame that he's putting around this for all kinds of ordinary people. I compare this with an Advent calendar that our family was given a couple years ago. And the Advent calendar has all kinds of activities for our family to do. But there was absolutely no guiding thesis for it whatsoever. And the general impression of that Advent calendar was, Advent is a time for you to be busy doing all kinds of things that have to do with Christianity and prayer. There was not a common theme. There was not a common focus. It was just be busy. And conversely, there are some wonderful resources. Come Worship With Me, A Journey Through the Christian Year. And would every church library actually be able to have a good set of children's books like this for recommendations in the home? If I were teaching, incidentally, and I'll end with this, if I were teaching this Christian Year class today, right, I think I'd still have my seminary students fill out that big, long chart. Well, maybe. I'd shorten it a little bit. But I think the thing I would want them to do today is to actually hand me, at the end of the semester, not a 20-page chart, not a 20-page paper. I think I would ask them to actually write the text of a 20-page children's book on the Christian year. Word limit for the entire book, 300 words. Can you frame the Christian year in a theocentric way for children in 300 years. 300 words.
Yes, I can do it.
Yes, you can do it. That's right. So that's the kind of question that I actually think is worth really pausing over. Time for lunch.